Okay, we'll turn to this evening to Matthew's Gospel in chapter 2, please. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 2. In one sense, I'm not chasing after Christmas yet, really. But as I studied over this passage over the last number of weeks, I really felt I wanted to speak on a few themes that are here. I'm not going to refer to them as wise men or kings. The word is a difficult word. It's magi. Exactly what it means, it certainly doesn't mean kings, and there certainly wasn't three of them of necessity. It's wise men, possibly. So I'm going to use the word magi tonight, and that's the reason why. We just do not know the translation of who exactly these guys were. So we read verse 1. After Jesus was, and it's important to notice it says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem, the nativity's over. Okay. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi came from the east to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and the teachers of the law, he asked them, "Where the Messiah was to be born?" "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave them orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said to the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said to the prophets, "He will be called a Nazarene." A very interesting passage in the Word of God. Well, I do want to call your attention to Matthew chapter 2 this evening. It's one of the stories we actually usually get it at Christmas, but we don't actually read the whole chapter very often, do we? It's one of those passages that if we do read it at all, at best we're selective in our reading. We leave out bits. There's a whole lot of bit at the end we don't bother with. We just sort of pick out the nice bits in the middle. The bit that fits the lovely sentimental picture of the three, the angels somewhere up in the sky and the star and the shepherds and the lovely three kings all around the manger, and it's a wonderful thing, and you see it in all the Christmas cards. That's the sort of passage that we pick out of this, and we read it. But yet it's a passage which is filled with brutality. The brutality of the slaughter has been called of the innocents, a passage which reminds us that the world that Jesus came into was a world of absolute brutality, a world, in fact, in which he had to become, to use the modern phrase, a refugee. He had to flee. He had to get out of town, get out very quickly in the middle of the night before he lost his life. I wonder, have you ever actually asked yourself why Matthew wrote this story? He certainly didn't write it for Christmas. The whole thing of Christmas readings, etc., just didn't enter his head. And yet when you recognize that this story, this passage takes up the whole of chapter 2, it takes up 23 verses, and you thought tonight, boy, he's reading an awful lot tonight, isn't he? He's gone on and on, and it's one of those long readings. We don't really deal with that, do we? But Matthew deliberately put this story here, because don't forget, he didn't have a word processor. He wasn't a blogger who could just tap away on the keyboards and the words could just pile up one on top of the other. He had a scroll of a certain length. And to get his message down, he had to have it. He had to get it into that thing. So for Matthew, this was a very important incident. These 23 verses took up a lot of space, and they took up a lot of time, and they took up of effort. If you ever ask the question, why? Why is it here? Well, the first answer to that is quite simply this: because it happened. He's recording something that happened. Now, you will hear clever men on the television or the radio, perhaps over Christmas, and they'll tell you things like, well, it's recorded in no other book in history anywhere, and we really can't believe this. Well, hold on a minute, you know. What we're not talking here is about the wholesale slaughter of hundreds of kids. We're talking about a little town of Bethlehem, and on the size that archaeologists see it was in the vicinity around it, we're probably talking about 20, possibly 30 kids under 2 years old for the population of that time. Wasn't that big of a deal, unless you're one of the parents who saw your child taken out on a spear or a sword stuck through him. But it was one of those events that took place. The second reason is this: he wants to make a point about Jesus. Because don't forget, the Gospels were not written as storybooks. They were written about men by men who, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, wanted to communicate a message about Jesus Christ. And they just didn't sort of break it up into chapters with wee bits. They wrote the whole book together. They wanted to make a point. And in fact, the whole of the chapter actually turns on the question, where is he that has been born King of the Jews? That's the question that sets the scene. That's the question, when the Magi ask it, that sends the shudders through Jerusalem. Because they're quite clearly of the opinion and the understanding that it's more than just a child who's born in the thing, because they go on to say, we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. We have come to worship. You don't normally come to worship a king. There is a sudden dimension that here is more than just an ordinary king. Here is someone that has come, the King of the Jews, the promised one of the Old Testament period. And of course, Herod understands it. Is that complete? Completely, because he immediately calls the leaders of the people again. He says, where will Messiah be born? He doesn't actually say, who's this about this king, this kid? No, he asks about Messiah. And we're to understand that these men came understanding and knowing that they were asking about the one who was the appointed King of the Jews, the one who would come as the rescuer and deliverer, the Messiah. And in fact, when you think about it, these Magi were actually very brave or very stupid. Because Herod had a terrible reputation. Herod had killed people in his own court to hold on to his throne. Herod had killed members of his own family to hold on to his position. He was a ruthless, cruel man. And when it says that all Jerusalem was disturbed with him, it was a disturbing question that came to them. And it was no surprise, because he was paranoid about his position. He would not stoop to wipe anybody out that he thought would take away his place. He held on to it with a terrible ferocity. All Jerusalem, were they all sad for him? No, I think it was a bit like sometimes when Theresa May decides to change her cabinet. They're all wondering who's going to get the knife from that night. And there were a lot of people around the court saying, how's this going to break out? Is there going to be another purge? Am I going to get caught in the draft? Am I going to be someone who falls out here? What's going to happen? Who do I need to support? Who am I going with? So there's a whole disturbance in Jerusalem, because it is that Messiah has come. How do we react to all of that? Well, probably we look at it and we can turn and say it belongs to a far off time and a particularly horrible man. No place in our world today. It's nothing to do with us. We're reading about people who were, you know, a bit simple in those days, very cruel, and, well, you know, it belongs way back there. But we are the scientific age. We're the people who know. But think again. Think again of Srebrenica. Think again of the Syrian villages that we've watched on our televisions, gassed, and hundreds of people wiped out. Think of Yemen. Did you see the pictures last week on the television of the starving children, of the horrible injuries? Myanmar and all the people who had to flee to Bangladesh. Zimbabwe. But then we say, those are foreign places. Doesn't really belong here. Those are less educated people and lands. You know, we're the sophisticated West. We know. Sorry. What about Manchester Arena? What about London Bridge? What about Omagh? What about Enniskillen? Oh, well, we say they're terrorist scum. That's what they are. They're not normal. There's something wrong with them fellas. And you see the headlines in the press the next day, the scum, and all the names that we can get for them. We categorize them as evil, ugly, terrible men. And then somebody gets a father, and they say to him, why did your son do this? I don't know. He was just a normal wee fella. He grew up here. I had no idea this was going to happen. He was just ordinary. And when you see them dragged into the courts, they're just ordinary people. Somebody's son, somebody's daughter. Just ordinary people. So the disturbing question still goes on. Where does all this come from? What's the source of it? Matthew wants us to think about that. What's the source of it? Well, if we go to the people at the bottom of the pile, it's the Herods of this world. It's the powerful, it's the well-off, it's those great industrialists. And yes, I'm quite sure they do take their power seriously, and there's people are downtrodden and people are walked over and people are that. They're the people to blame. But then if I go along and I talk to the people of power, they'll tell us it's about the people at the bottom end, those irresponsible, immoral people at the bottom who do all these terrible things. They're to blame. And then there's you and me in the middle. And we're just decent, ordinary, hardworking people. And it's everybody else is the problem. Not us. But then the teaching of the Bible is this. That every human heart is the source of this world's evil. Every human heart is the source of this world's evil. And it moves from a disturbing question to a searching question, a searching question not only for Herod, but for you and me. For you see, the issue is this. If you desire to be king, and someone else claims to be king, the two of you can't exist together. As they used to say in the old westerns, when two gunfighters come into the same town, this town ain't big enough for you and me. That's the reality. Herod knew immediately, we can't exist together. It's either him or me. That's what it's about. One has to give way. And that's the point that Matthew is making here. Jesus has come into the world as the Son of God. He has come as God into time. He has come as the King who has the right to rule everything. And Herod is you and me. And the searching question is quite simply this. Jesus comes demanding absolute submission. Matthew will present him in chapter 10 in these terms, where Jesus says, anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. I've got to be first. It doesn't mean we've got to hate people or we've got to turn away from them, but he's saying, if I am not the one at the top end, I am not there. He demands a totalitarian submission to him. I am number one. He says, anyone who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. And again, we need to understand those words. When you took up your cross, there was only one thing was going to happen. You were going to die. And Jesus says, you will give your life to me as if you were going out to die. You've got to give up all rights to yourself. And he will make it clear when he says this, whoever finds his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Jesus Christ has come as the King of the Jews. He has come as God's Messiah, and he comes with that demand of the King that we yield to him, that we submit to him. That's the bit that we find hard to take. It triggers a resistance in our hearts. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. Nobody's going to tell me how to live my life. I am quite happy to make up my own mind. No one's going to tell me what to do. Well, Jesus Christ says that's the condition. Paul puts it like this in Romans 8. The sinful mind is hostile, is enmity to God. It does not submit to God's law, nor indeed can it do so. We won't yield, nor can we. But of course, we've domesticated that. We've learned to. We've learned to hide that side of our nature. We like to be known as team players, as those who are cooperative, those who are kind and loving people. But right at the bottom of it all is number one. Right at the bottom of it all is the addiction to me and mine. Is the demand that the desire that the whole world revolves around me. That I make my decisions. That I go my way. All evil in the world ultimately stems from that source. Out of the source, the center of our being, out of our hearts flows all evil because we want to live for ourselves. Each of us a little Herod, we will be keen and master of our own fate. I quoted it this morning. I probably quote it too often, but Frank Sinatra got it. I did it my way. And that's the point that's been made here. That's the searching question that is put here. The Bible sums it up like this. Romans 3, 10, 11. There is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. Now, hold on a minute, preacher. That's just going a bit too far. That is just a wee bit too harsh. I know everybody's not perfect. I know everybody's, you know, they've got their edges and they've got their moments, but really, come on. What about the good people who love? The good people who help, who show forgiveness? What about the people all over the world who seek God? You know, we're not all atheists. There are many people who seek God and they do it their own way. You're saying that they're all wrong? Well, let me give you two answers to that. First of all, to seek love, to give help, to be forgiving, to seek happiness, is not to seek God. You see, there's what you can call what I get out of it mentality. I'm in it for what I get. I'm that sort of person. I like to be that, and that's the way I go, and that's the way I do. And there are people in the world like that. And the second thing is this, that though the world today wants to say that all roads lead to God, the Bible is abundantly clear that the God you seek, if it's not the God of the Bible, is not the living God. And so with our religion, we try to domesticate God. We like to get him into the place where we need a God that we think we need, one that we can accept, one that suits my needs, one who serves me, one that will not demand too much for me, one that will get me sort of into heaven at the end of the day, but I can keep my foot on the other side of the line. What's the sentimental God of the Christmas fairy tale will do, won't he? We'll hear all about it. The values of the family, the values of being kind, the values of doing good, the values of being peaceful. That's the sort of God we want. That's all we want to hear from. He will do. But if it's the one who came to Bethlehem, the one who was born King of the Jews, the one who is Messiah, the one who is none other than the God of the universe who demands everything from us. He made us. We are his, and he demands all of us. And the truth is this, friends, we will not seek him unless we're moved by the Holy Spirit. As we face King Jesus, we'd either use our religion. I pray. I say my prayers. I read my Bible. I do the best I can. I go to church every Sunday. I'm basically a good person. We'll use our self-righteousness. There's always somebody worse you can find. There's him over there. Oh, there's her. You know, I'm not in that league. But that's not what he asks. He asks for me. Or we can take the position of the atheist. We will deny him, proclaiming loudly, there is no God. Interestingly, I read a couple of philosophers over the last year, one called Nagel. And Nagel said this, I would have put this up on the screen, excuse me when I squint at my hieroglyphics. Here's what he said. I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want a universe like that. The cosmic authority problem is more common than we realize. And what he's saying is, I just don't want him. The cosmic authority problem, the God who says you will do, you will bow before me. We won't have it. Adolphus Huxley was one of the great proponents as early that brought in the whole new sexual revolution. And in one of his books, he honestly admits that it suited him to have no God because he wanted to live as he liked. I haven't got the quote to hand, but I could get it to you. I also remember one evening seeing a BBC Two Horizon program. And again, we're discussing the beginning of the universe, all those things that go on. And they brought this guy on. They were asking the hard question, how did it begin? And he said, if I had to go to the Supreme Court of the United States, I could not present enough evidence to prove my case. But I cannot accept the alternative. The authority question. I don't want it. I cannot. I won't. That is the very heart of what is here. Either we will bow before him, or we'll take the place of Herod, and we'll join the crowd at the trial of Jesus as the gospel closes. Away with him. Crucify him. As Jesus put it so eloquently in the story of the servants, we will not have this man to rule over us. We won't have him. That is the issue that's here. That is the challenge of the coming of Jesus Christ. The King has come, and he demands absolute submission. But not only is it a disturbing question and a searching question, completely different. It's a different king. There are two kings in this passage. There's Herod, and there's Jesus. And we're to see a comparison. We're to see there's a difference here. The Magi did what everybody else would do, didn't they? Where do you find a king? You find him in the palace. And they went to the palace because that's where you think you'll find it. But the message here is that Jesus is a different king. He does not come with power and with wealth or academic eloquence. He comes in weakness. He has to run away in the face of a Herod, and he has to spend years in Egypt that he may be protected and kept. He comes to Nazareth, said Nathanael. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Who lives in that dump? What could come out of that place? That's what he said. That's what he meant. He came to the carpenter's bench. You ever think about that? He was just a tradesman. He was just a poor, ordinary guy who worked. If you'd taken the hands of Jesus, there weren't soft hands like mine. There'd been hands like Big Sam that I used to have in Dundonald. He had hands like iron. And there were calluses all over them because he worked the tools. When you got Sam's hand at the door, you had to actually make sure you grabbed it right or you got your hand crushed. But they were calloused hands. And you know, friends, the more I thought about Sam's big hands, those are the hands of Jesus. The calloused hands of a workman in a town called Nazareth. It was a bit of a dump. That's God's way of doing things right throughout all the scripture. God takes those who are nothing, people who can do nothing, and he uses them. So he comes to the barren woman. He comes to Sarah, who's in her 90s, and says, your child is going to be, your son is going to be the one through whom I'm going to bless the world. Why? To show that he alone could do it. He comes to Hannah, to Samuel's mother, who's barren and broken and empty, and he says, you're going to have the first of the prophets. He comes to Elizabeth, Mary's cousin, up in the hill country, a lady who can't have children. He says, from you, the forerunner is going to come. He takes an Abraham, a man who lives far away. He says, Abraham, get out. I'm going to show you where to, I'm not going to tell you where to go. Just go. And when you get there, I'll tell you. And in you, I am going to make all the nations of the earth blessed. And nobody from far away who comes, who becomes a refugee, who becomes someone who has no resident place within anywhere, and out of him, God makes a nation. God fulfills his purposes. He comes to a Jacob, a lying cheat, who has to run from his own family, far away, where he diddles his father-in-law, where he plays fast and loose until God comes and he breaks him. And in that lying cheat, God picks up a man and he uses him as the one through whom he would form Israel. He comes to a Moses with all his education, with all the greatness. He has to run away into the backside of the desert, a broken, empty man who's out there and he doesn't want to come back. And God says, Moses, it's you. He comes to a David. He comes to a David who's the wee fellow they sent out to look after the sheep while the rest of the family went to war. Get away out there. You're only a wee fella. And then him becomes the great symbol of Messiah. Great David's greater son. He is the king of the Jews. He becomes that model. What is all that saying to us? Why does scripture deal with that? Because Jesus turns the world's values of success upside down. Our world values influence, talent, wealth, and beauty. Look at the talent contest we have. Look at the television. All that emptiness. This one and that one and the other one. All to have talent, all to have beauty, all to have wealth, all to have success. And Jesus says, no. His coming says no. And he calls us to follow him. Because Jesus comes as the one who gives his undeserved favor. Every other religion in the world will tell you to do something. Pull yourself up. Try a little harder. Meditate every day. Do this, do that. Do a little more kindness. Do something. That's the way it goes. But Jesus comes and says, I've come to do it. I have come to do it. I have come as God's person. In the weakness, I have come and I have come to do it. You ever notice it through the Gospels when the disciples begin to understand something that he is the Messiah? They keep saying to him, when are you going to take the power and rule? When's the kingdom going to come? When are you going to do it? When are you going to get it? He says, you don't understand. I've come to suffer and to die. I've come in weakness. I have come as the one who must suffer and die. And so the king goes to the cross under the title, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. And from a cross he reigns. From a cross he does a great work. For his weakness is our strength. His death is our life. His apparent defeat is our victory. He is the message of hope. That's what Christmas is about. That's what Matthew's trying to say. The king has come. The king is able to take anyone and to make them new. There is hope for you and me, because God can take the weak and the nothing and the broken and the empty. I don't care who you are and I don't care what you've done. I know who I am and I know what I've done over the years, but he comes and he is able to save completely all who come and fall at his feet. He delights to do it. He delights to do it. Here's what Paul says. God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. And we're back again. He is king. We fall at his feet. And we worship him. Have you done it yet? Have you come to that place where you've given up the reins? That's a hard thing to do. It's only by the grace of God we can do it. But friends, I've got to confront you and ask you the question, have you given up the reins? Or are you still being king? It's something that will be progressive through all of our Christian lives. That's why we sang some of the songs we did. Because let's be honest, friends, in every one of us, a wee bit of the king still remains. I've had to fight it for years. I'm still fighting it. I don't know about you, but it's very easy to see the old thing come up and nobody's going to... Lord, what do you want? What do you want from me? What are you calling me to do? It goes on. It's progressive as the years go by, as he puts his hand out and says, I want that. I want that. I want that. The Lordship of Christ is not something of a moment that begins there, but it goes on for the rest of our lives as he works. And he says, anyone who comes after me must lose his life. And that's hard. Thank goodness for the grace of God that enables us to do it, even so imperfectly and so poorly at times. But friend, do you know it tonight? Are you at his feet? Have you acknowledged him? For let me remind you that the king who has come, the king of the Jews, Christmas isn't over. He's coming again. He came in weakness to save, but the king is coming in glory and power to rule. Matthew, I'll tell you about it next Sunday morning if you come back, tells us the 49th year has only begun and the fullness is yet to come. And friend, and in time or in eternity, every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. You can do it in time, or you will do it in eternity.